As Ryan's hand darted for the butt of his Sig Sauer, Hatcher brought his own weapon up and over his head. The hatchet rotated through the air on a direct line with Ryan's head. Ryan didn't have time to aim. He just squeezed the trigger from the hip. The hatchet spun off harmlessly to the side. Hatcher charged.
You ruined me!
The raw power of Hatcher stunned Ryan. As he fell, the Sig Sauer flew from his hands. Hatcher picked it up.
I want the map and my gold, you one-eyed son of a bitch!
Suddenly, Hatcher's deerskin shirt front acquired a ragged hole, and a splash of crimson spread across it in an artless pattern. Both men turned to look, and both of them saw Felicity struggling over the lip of the hill, a gun in her right hand, a tendril of pale smoke curling from the barrel. Her left hand held another flintlock pistol, and she lifted it to fire again. One side of her face was completely covered with a sliding flow of blood, gushing from a bullet wound in her scalp.
Oh, you bitch!
Felicity's body was jolted backward and to one side. The shockwaves of the bullet's impact traveled down her arm and sent the unfired pistol twirling from her fingers. In one sweeping red-tinted glance, Ryan saw Felicity's flintlock lying only 3 feet from his right hand, the cache of gunpowder, and the 2-foot length of fuse that ran from it. As Ryan's fingers closed over the flintlock, Hatcher spun toward him and lunged. Ryan fell onto his back, and unable to check his plummet, Hatcher met his adversary's uplifted boots with his stomach. The pirate fell to the ground, his lungs screaming for air. Ryan dived forward, thumbing back the pistol's hammer. Hitting the ground, he aimed the weapon toward the fuse. A spark jumped and touched the powder-treated fuse. The spark smoked its way along the fuse.
Oh, shit! No!
The explosion dazzled Ryan, deafened him, coated him with a fine layer of dust, and the concussion rolled him over and over. Through the tongues of flame, the upflung clouds of smoke and grit, he glimpsed a dark shape flying overhead, limbs flailing. Peering through the shifting planes of smoke, Ryan saw the entire edge of the ridge sliding from view. Rock cracked and split. Then the entire wall of the gorge was in motion, flowing down in a grinding, crashing torrent. Ryan got to his feet and peered down. He had only the briefest of glimpses of buckskin-clad men jamming the narrow passage below. Then they were blocked from sight by the downrushing tons of dirt, shale, and sandstone. The few of the cadre still out on the plain began to race toward the windwags. There was less than a dozen, and they all clambered aboard the largest craft, fighting one another to align the sail and to start the engine. There was no strategy, no order, only the half-mad desire to flee. Ryan rose and looked down over the Amican defenses. Everyone was looking up at him. He waved. Ryan picked up his Sig Sauer and absently brushed away the grit. Then he saw that halfway down the hill lay Felicity's body, arms outflung, face turned to the sky. Far above her, with wings outstretched, a hawk glided gracefully on the air currents. The sickening odor of scorched human hair and flesh was more overpowering than the acrid reek of burned powder. Sprawled face down at the far end of the hilltop was John Hatcher. Smoke curled from the seat and legs of the man's pants. The loose-limbed, fire-blackened shape moved. John Jacob Hatcher was still alive. His long hair was blackened to a crisp, only a stinking, smoking fuzz covering his head. His beard was a smoldering patch of charred bristles, and his face was covered by red, raw patches and huge, leaking blisters. Hey, Hatchet Jack. You wanted this map? Ryan leaned over and touched one corner of the parchment to a tiny flame on the man's pant leg. The map went up in a flash of fire and cinders. Ryan blew the handful of ashes directly into Hatcher's face. The ashes scattered, dancing on the breeze. The wind shredded the gray scraps to bits, leaving only a thin residue adhering to Hatcher's peeled, sticky flesh.
I gave you exactly what you wanted, Hatcher. No quarter.
Grandfather, Great Spirit, you have been always, and before you no one has been. Grandmother Earth, you who have shown mercy to your children, who have ripped and burned and poisoned you, I shall heal you.
I shall heal you. That dream again. What?
Ryan lunged up from the cot, staring wildly around the dim room. A shadow slid past the open window and was gone before his blurred eye could focus. He scrambled to the window.
Who's there?
Could have sworn there was somebody.
Ryan stood at the window, confused and a little angry, his mind still fogged by fatigue. The tension of his nerves eased. There was nothing out there in the dark but a few lights and bodies that had yet to be recovered. Scraps of pink and orange began to glow in the eastern sky. The cool air still retained a faint odor of blood, gunpowder, and seared human flesh. Making a deliberate effort to push away the strangeness of his dream and the voice in his mind, he sat on the edge of the narrow bed and tugged on his boots. He checked his chron, noting it was nearly 24 hours to the minute since the Red Cadre had arrived. During the day and most of the night following the battle, he and his friends had patched up their wounds as best they could and helped the survivors of the battle collect and tidy the dead. The thought of remaining in Amicus another day suddenly revolted Ryan. He went through the door into the common room of the little hostel. Jack and Christy sat at the table with a pot of the pungent tea before them. Doc stood shaving in front of a tiny trade mirror, carefully scraping the straight razor across his face. Mildred and JB were evidently still asleep.
Did you call out in there?
Maybe.
That dream?
I don't know. Thought I heard someone outside the window.
Who?
Probably just dreamed it.
I'm not surprised. The past few days have been a nightmare. And if what's left of the Red Cadre manages to regroup...
We'll be long gone before that happens. Let's be out of here after breakfast.
I'd hoped you might stay. Until lunch, at least.
Ryan turned, facing Autry, who leaned against the doorframe. He was wearing a woolly buffalo robe that was far too big for him. His gentle, bearded face sagged with pain and grief.
We'd rather get on the move as soon as possible.
We'll be sorry to see you go. Amicus owes you a great debt. What's left of it?
Give us some food and some mounts and we'll call it even.
Where will you go?
Does it matter?
I suppose not. I'll have some food brought to you. Oh, if you're looking for a guide, there's a Lakota tribesman who arrived late last night. He wants to talk to you.
Who is he?
Little Mountain. Remember him? He says he's a highly placed war chief.
You mean this Yutan Kinmahipia?
The very same. Says he knows you.
Knows who?
All of you. Wait a minute, I'll fetch him.
Through the open door, they watched Autry cross the street toward a teepee. A man sat there, wearing a hooded deerskin cape. He rose with the lithe, coiled movements of a panther when Autry approached. There was something vaguely familiar about his smooth, quick motions. He cradled a Gewehr automatic assault rifle in his arms. Autry and the stranger marched across the street. As they entered the room, the man pulled back the hood of his cape. His face was lean and sharply planed. His black-haired head was alertly erect, and a pair of red hawk feathers were pinned at the back. He was no wild tribesman. His face and dark eyes had fire and pride and a haughty intelligence. Mildred recognized him first.
Touch the sky!
Call me Joe. I'm pleased you remember me.
Ryan wasn't sure if he was pleased or not. The summer before, they had met Touch the Sky in the Black Hills. Though they hadn't been allies, the Lakota and his band of warriors had saved Christy, Mildred, JB, Jack, and Doc from the guns of Hellscale's Sekhmen. From what he had been told, the rescue had been unintentional, more of a byproduct of the Lakota's attack on Lars Hellstrom and his squad of Sekhmen. Touch the Sky himself, who preferred to be called Joe by the whites, prowled the ancient tribal lands of his people, seeking out and punishing interlopers and desecrators. He had warned them about the kill-crazy citizens of the settlement of Hellscale, and a few days later, Ryan had spared the man's life,
when he could have just as easily ended it. Under the circumstances, he supposed they owed each other nothing, and had renewed their relationship on fresh terms.
Autry told us your name was Yutan Keen something or other.
That's the Lakota pronunciation. The English translation is, of course, Touch the Sky.
Care to join us for breakfast?
Thank you, no. This isn't the social call. When Little Mountain told me that Ochina'e, that's you, Mr. Cawdor, and his friends were here in Amicus, threatened by the Red Cadre, I came straight away. I arrived too late to help rout them, I see.
Now, that blaster of yours would have been a big help to us. As it is, some got away.
The survivors, the stragglers, have already been dealt with.
You said this isn't a social call. What do you want with us?
Joe pointed through the open door toward the gray-green mountains on the horizon.
My people dwell there in the mountains you call the Wind River Range, in a valley called Tiratwa. We have enemies there, and they are too powerful for us to conquer on our own. We have few weapons. I came to Amicus when I heard you were here because you left Hellskell aflame and drove their evil from my people's ancestral land. You can help us in our struggle.
Ryan suddenly felt certain that Joe wasn't seeking aid to win a petty intertribal conflict. The stakes were far larger than property or hunting rights.
We're not mercies.
You are warriors, and that is enough. I hope to reach Amicus in time to aid you in your battle with the Cadre, and you would subsequently discharge the debt by helping me. Therefore, we must bargain. Though I won't pay you, I will reward you.
Reward us with what?
Joe reached beneath his deerskin cloak and brought forth a dully gleaming object that he laid carefully, almost reverently, on the tabletop. It was a flat wafer of dull yellow metal, several inches long. Inset on either side of the wafer were two small hexagons of crystal. Though they looked like quartz, there was something odd about their structure. Each was only an inch in diameter, but bore an interlocking pattern of facets that blurred the vision, made it difficult to focus directly on them.
Gee, more shiny metal.
What do you mean?
Here's some gold. Got this off Hatchet Jack.
That is from Tiratwa. It is the Mazuska Joaquin. How did he get it?
He never said. He was more concerned about accruing more.
Well, there is more. All you can carry away, if you help me.
That map Hatcher had on him. It must have been legitimate after all.
Ryan, this could be big. All the years you and me traveled with Trader, we never had an opportunity like this.
Jack merely gazed impassively at the metal wafer. Doc looked interested, but not particularly excited. Christy and Mildred eyed Ryan, waiting for his reaction. He examined the slice of gold.
It looks almost like it was machined. More like some kind of instrument, not an ornament.
It came from a cavern in Tiratwa.
Did your people mine it?
There is much more like it there.
That's no answer. Is there a gold mine in this Tiratwa of yours?
Tiratwa? That seems familiar, from my Native American studies.
Your answer, Ochina'e. Will you come?
Ryan exchanged a quick glance with Christy. Her hair wasn't stirring, and she shrugged, indicating she sensed no danger, or at least not an immediate threat. Still, there was too much about Joe's proposal that was in the dark. But the promise of a definite destination was a strong inducement.
I won't commit us to anything without a discussion. We've just fought one battle for others. That might be enough for a while. I'll let you know by sundown.
Until then.
With that, Joe picked up the gold wafer and stepped out of the room and into the street.
You know, he doesn't seem like a fool, but doesn't he realize with your blasters and skill you can just take his gold and walk off with it?
No matter what we agree to do, we'd never do that. If we were that sort, we'd have sold out your vill to Hatchet Jack.
Of course. I'm sorry. I'm just tired. I'll leave you now.
So, what is your initial reaction to our American native's invitation?
To tell him thanks, but no thanks?
Gold is still the best grease in most of Deathlands.
Mildred, you said there was something familiar about this place.
Vaguely. When I minored in American Indian culture, my studies revolved around tribal linkages and genotyping, though I did touch on creation myths from time to time.
And?
There's a legend among some plains tribes that says the source of creation came from a cave in a valley. Tiratwa means, roughly, sacred or mystery valley.
Is this place anything like the vills of Cibola and El Dorado you told us about?
No, not really. It's more of a Garden of Eden type of myth. I remember a bit of poetry about it. Magic to Ratwa, life, death, good, evil, joy, sorrow, all born in the cavern of creation.
You're talking about a myth, but Joe said he actually came from Tiratwa.
The tribe in the mountains probably named their valley after the legend.
Are you suggesting Joe wants us to fight a war in the Native American equivalent of Eden?
I'm suggesting nothing of the sort. Frankly, I'm not even sure if I'm remembering the legend correctly, since all cultures share similar creation myths. I may be confusing Tiratwa with Tir na n'og, the ancient Celtic land of promise. The two words are similar linguistically. It's been a very, very long time, and my memory is faulty. You should be able to relate to that, Doc.
At the reminder of his own unreliable thought processes, Doc lapsed into an abashed silence.
I'll leave this discussion to a vote, since nobody but me seems anxious to leave this place. On the one hand, we can turn Joe down and stay, maybe help Amicus rebuild. On the other hand, we can accept Joe's offer, have a destination in mind, and at least be on our way to somewhere again.
This really all boils down to whether we trust Joe.
Only one way to find out.
Joe? We've been talking about it. We're going to accept your offer and go with you.
Very well. We will embark at dawn tomorrow. The journey to the valley will take 3 or 4 days. I'll buy your mount and pack animals.
Good. We'll meet you at the hotel at sunrise tomorrow.
To pass the time until the next day, Ryan toured Amicus with his friends. He soon regretted ever raising the possibility of staying to help the citizens rebuild. The population had been reduced by 1/3, and the elderly and children had been pressed into service as medical aides and undertakers. The tavern served as a hospital, and the boneyard contained the unburied dead. The bodies of the Amican defenders were covered with blankets and hides. The corpses of the Red Cadre had been stripped and dumped unceremoniously on the heap of animal bones and left to rot. The few able-bodied people in the ville were working at clearing the pass sufficiently so it could be used again as an egress. As they passed them by, the Amicans eyed the companions distrustfully, even angrily. Ryan wasn't pleased that his assessment of their prevailing attitude had been so accurate. Rebuilding the open ville of Amicus seemed like far more effort than it was worth. They returned to their quarters in the afternoon to rest. Ryan and Christy lay together in the narrow bunk, but she was unresponsive to his caresses. She was troubled, haunted by what had happened the day before. She was also exhausted, as all of them were, since they had gone for nearly 40 tension-drenched hours without sleep. Their rest the night following the battle had been fitful. As aching and as tired as he was, Ryan found he was a little afraid of falling asleep. He tried to repress the memories of the voice echoing through his dream, but he still felt uneasy. He had experienced nightmares before, many of the most vivid and terrifying after a long Matrans jump. He couldn't understand why he was so disturbed by his dreams of the wolf and the voice, except that he harbored a flicker of suspicion that they hadn't been dreams at all. But exhaustion drove him into a deep slumber. Ryan awakened at close to sunset, and he found he was alone, not only in the room, but the entire hostel. He went out onto the twilight streets of Amicus. He walked toward the big corral to find out how Joe's preparations for the journey were coming along. He didn't trust the Lakota any more than any other stranger he had met in his many years of trekking across Deathlands. The air was still musky with the odor of violence and death. Usually after a victory, the air smelled new, sweet and sharp. It was becoming apparent that he had seen too much death in his years, played too much a part in adding to the world's store of it. To cheat death, he had to deal death. He wondered what would happen when his killer's reflexes no longer obeyed his killer's instincts. Ryan came to a sudden stop on the uneven ground. Tawny, greenish-gold eyes blazed at him from directly ahead in the gloom. A dark, shaggy, silver-shot shape crouched in the shadows, staring at him. For an instant, Ryan thought it was a dog. Then his hand went to the Sig Sauer at his hip. The creature was too big for a dog, Its head a trifle too wide, the tail too bushy, the posture too feral. It was a wolf, watching his every move with a hypnotic intensity. Though very large, probably tipping the scales at close to 160 pounds, the wolf wasn't one of the muty strains that prowled the Rockies. Ryan carefully unleathered his gun.
He will not harm you. He is a friend.
She came toward him out of the dusk, past the crouching wolf. Her movements were light and lithe, with a grace that reminded him somehow of Joe. She wore the combination of homespun and buckskin clothing of the Amakins, and at first he took her for a Cheyenne. Her waist-length hair was sleek and black enough, but the face it framed wasn't ruddy, and her eyes were a brown so light they were almost tan, or a shade of gold. There was pride and a touch of arrogance in those eyes, though there was something oddly childlike in them too, almost innocence. She didn't look more than 18 years old.
I am Shishoka. It means robin's wing. His name is Wikma. It means blood sniffer.
I'm Ryan Carter.
I have seen you here in Amicus before the battle.
I don't recall seeing you or your friend. I think I'd remember you both.
The instant he said it, he regretted it. With a chilly sensation at the base of his spine, he realized the wolf did indeed look familiar.
You fought well. You saved Amicus.
Uh-huh.
You look tired and a little sad. Is it because you are leaving us?
Ryan glanced again at the wolf. It was still watching him with that fixed, faintly luminous green-gold gaze.
If you'll pardon me?
You look as if you've had some bad dreams.
What did you say?
Touch the sky offers you only another bad dream, Ryan Carter.
The caution and instinctive suspicion that had kept Ryan alive for 2 decades in the Deathland Hill Zones came up to triple red.
What do you know of Tirawa?
Kill.
The wolf struck Ryan full in the chest, knocking him sprawling. He felt razor-keen fangs on his right forearm, keeping his gun hand immobilized. Ryan knew that before he could switch the weapon to his left hand or even draw his panga, his throat would be ripped out. Paws tore rents in his shirt, and the jaws increased their pressure around his arm.
Let me go!
Ryan wrapped his legs around the wolf's body and rolled to the left in an effort to outmuscle the animal long enough to unscabbard his blade. The wolf resisted his maneuver, shifting its weight. As he strained and wrestled, Ryan received the strange impression that despite the young woman's command, the wolf had no intention of killing him, as though it were acting on its own agenda.
Ryan!
Wetnya! Down!
The wolf released its grip on Ryan's arm. It jumped away, putting its weight on Ryan's chest.
Ryan, are you okay?
That girl, where is she?
Christy gestured to the northeast. In the uncertain starlight, Ryan got a shadowy glimpse of a horse and rider and a loping wolf racing past the boneyard and toward the bluffs beyond.
Who was she? What did it do to your arm?
She spoke to that wolf and it attacked me. She told it to kill me.
Why?
Maybe Joe can make an educated guess.
They found Joe at the corral, overseeing the selection and hobbling of their mounts. He stood tensely, his figure telegraphing impatience. Jack and Doc were watching the procedure from the split-rail fence.
Ryan. Coming to check up on my selection?
Who is Shishoka?
How do you know her?
She introduced herself to me right before she sicked her pet wolf on my ass. She comes from Tirawa too, doesn't she?
Shishoka here, and Wetna. They followed me, spied on me.
Doc and Jack moved closer to hear the exchange. Ryan's arm was throbbing and burning, blood streaming from the cuts to splatter on the ground.
Who the fuck is she?
She is the niece of Pizzi, chief of the Akichita Sunkamitu Tanka.
I never heard of that tribe.
It is not a tribe. It is a warrior society. It means the wolf soldiers. They are enemies of my people.
And who are your people exactly?
Kichiyuha Makoholaka. Loosely translated, it means the cavern keepers. The wolf soldiers are striking at us here. They intend to prevent us from reaching Tirawa. We must go swiftly if you are to help me and win your gold.
Gold seems less alluring at this juncture, especially if we must contend with a witch woman and her animal familiar.
Ryan was angry, mainly because he was a little frightened of the girl and the wolf, and the dream.
You are Ochinae, the one-eyed warrior who brought so much sorrow to the half-men in the Black Hills. Surely you are not afraid. Surely you will not renege on your word.
Ryan resisted the urge to barrel-stroke the Lakota across the face with his Sig Sauer.
All will become clear to you in time. Until then, know this. You will be fighting to heal the wounds of Grandmother Earth. I may sound a bit melodramatic, but this is not the time or the place to explain further. Shishoka may have other spies here.
Jack pointed to a nearby dog who sat licking its privates.
Who? Him?
You have my word, Ochinae.
I suppose that'll have to do for right now.
Hey, guys, how's it? Ryan, what the hell happened to you?
Met one of Joe's friends.
Who was he?
He was a wolf. Goes by the name Bloodsniffer. Some girl named Shishoka told him to do this.
Hold out your arm. We've got some corn liquor to disinfect the wound.
Ah.
These wounds are actually pretty superficial. Only needs the barest bit of cleaning and bandaging. You'll be fine, and the marks will be gone in a few days.
Interesting.
There's something else. Something Joe said bothered you.
Something Shishoka said bothered me more. Things about how I've been having bad dreams.
Have you?
Yeah, with wolves. I rode a wolf who restored my eye. The wolf took me through the Newcast and told me that the dead will live forever if they die inside a circle.
That's what Felicity said.
I know, but my dream was before that. And I've been having dreams like that for a couple nights now, since we first came to Amicus. Yeah?
Well, if I didn't know any better, I'd be of the opinion you experienced a vision or the beginnings of one.
A vision? Aren't you supposed to run away from the world and fast for weeks for one of those?
Well, I don't know if you were supposed to, but yes, it usually helped. But it wasn't necessary to have one.
Yeah, well, I don't want a vision. I see just fine as it is.
From what I've read, spirit guides and animal totems occasionally come unsolicited to befriend mortals. Maybe that's one interpretation.
A wolf? I can't think of any animal more appropriate to serve as your totem, my boy.
We really don't need to get tangled up in native religions.
Maybe not, but I can't help but wonder if we won't be.
Give me that bottle.
Ryan took a swallow of White Mule. A long one.
Wake up, sleepyhead.
Morning already?
Yep. Have any more dreams?
Oh, I don't remember shit. My head.
Oh, the corn liquor gets you.
I've changed my mind. Let's stay here and help rebuild Amicus.
No, you should have known better than to drink that rot gut on the night before a journey.
You didn't say anything.
I'm not your mother, Ryan. You go on and on about folks taking responsibility for their actions. Well, you'd better take responsibility for this hangover, or you'll be left behind.
Ryan felt too lousy to argue with her. At least he hadn't had another strange and disturbingly vivid dream. If he had dreamed at all, he couldn't recollect it.
Where's Joe?
Outside. He has our horses ready. You want breakfast?
No, please. No thanks.
Joe was waiting for them at the corner of the hostel, holding the lead ropes of 7 horses and 2 mules. The mules had supplies packed onto their backs. Everyone was pleased with Joe's ability to judge horse flesh, except for Doc. He had expressly asked for a small animal, so he would have less distance to fall when he was inevitably thrown, and Joe had chosen a dun-colored Mustang. Doc walked around the animal, studying its legs and withers. It was a little bigger in the chest than Joe's Pinto, and it gazed at Doc with an alert suspicion in its brown eyes. Doc took the reins from Joe and put one foot in the stirrup. The pony immediately shied, and Doc went down in the street.
Oh, Lord, the reincarnation of Judas.
With the help of JB and Joe, Doc managed to corner the little animal against the side of the hostel, and he climbed aboard the saddle. He squatted on the pony's back, feet in the stirrups, his knees sticking outward like a grasshopper's.
Just like Judas.
Well, then, that is what I shall christen him. Judas Redux.
Soon the party was all mounted, making for the pass. Though there were people up and about in Amicus, none spoke to them or bade them goodbye. Not even Mose Autry turned out to wish them good luck. Ryan wasn't surprised. The Amicans were probably just as relieved to see them go as the Red Cadre. They rode single file through the gorge, which had been cleared enough to make navigating it an extremely tight squeeze. They rode past the abandoned windwags, or what was left of them. Vengeful Amicans had dismantled them piece by piece. Only the skeletal wheelless frameworks lay on the plain. By the time they reached the open prairie, the sun was completely above the horizon, drenching the landscape with a yellow-red glow. The seven people, their horses and two mules, walked across the open grasslands of the Washakie Basin. Shallow coulees broke up the monotonous flatness of the plain, and here and there were cottonwood groves. They kept on a straight course for the Wind River mountain range far in the distance. So far, in fact, it seemed they couldn't possibly reach them in 3 years, much less 3 days. The stretch between the basin and the mountains was probably one of the least known regions of Deathlands. Even before the new cost, it hadn't been heavily populated. Even Trader and his old partner, Marsh Folsom, who had boasted a vast library of maps and pre-dark aerial surveys, knew little about the area. They rode through the morning, speaking very little. Joe was a cooperative, if somewhat taciturn, traveling companion. At mid-morning, they saw the black shapes of vultures wheeling and circling ahead of them. Their route brought them within a few hundred feet of one of the Red Cadre's windwags. It hadn't been touched, but bodies were strewn over the ground. The air buzzed with flies, and several vultures feasted on the banquet of rotting flesh, blood, and excrement. The body of a pirate dangled from the main mast of the wag, lashed upside down by the ankles. His cranium had been exposed by a scalping knife, revealing blue-white bone with a few clinging strips of red tissue. The stench made Ryan's mouth fill with sour saliva, and he cast a questioning look at Joe.
Did I mention that the survivors had been dealt with?
At noon, they ate, but rather than building a fire, they ate beef jerky, washing it down with swigs of water from their canteens. The company was in a better mood, and Ryan was almost completely recovered from his hangover. Joe didn't speak of their destination, or what they might find when they reached it. Gradually, the plains gave way to hilly terrain.
There's a river nearby. We will have to travel through cane breaks.
The party made for the river. Sure enough, the banks of the river were enclosed on both sides by huge breaks of cane. The cane breaks were of a sort Ryan had never seen or even imagined. From the hilltop, he had figured the stuff to be the same height and thickness as cane he had seen growing elsewhere, maybe 10 feet high, an inch around at the base. But these stalks of cane were thicker, and the shortest grew to a height of at least 25 feet. The bases were the diameter of his wrist. The growth was so densely packed that upon entering it, he was under the impression that a great cloud had passed over the face of the sun. The ground was marshy and soft, and snakes, frogs, and things less identifiable wriggled out of his horse's path. Insects whirled in abundance around everyone's faces and the eyes of their steeds. JB pulled off his fedora and tried to wave the buzzing, stinging horde away. What little sunlight that pierced the foliage arching overhead was of a pale greenish hue. The odor of rotting vegetation and sulfurous marsh gas became so strong that they all breathed through their mouths, though they ran the risk of inhaling a handful of bugs. Finally, the area around them started to thin out, and there was a draft of clean, untainted air. Sunlight, strong and warm, fell upon them. The river was a shallow one, with clear, frigid blue, mountain-fed water. It showed white foam in places, and small wavelets on the surface. The place where they were to ford was perhaps 60 or 70 feet wide.
The river is only 6-7 feet deep here, but it's running faster than usual. Be careful.
JB moved his horse close to Mildred's, and Ryan stood shoulder to shoulder with Christy. The horses were fearful of the crossing, though the mules displayed no nervousness. Ryan and Christy hung back until most of the others had gained the opposite shore. Then they urged their mounts into the water. The water lapped at Ryan's shins, his thighs, then his waist, and to the base of his horse's neck. The animal was forced to walk across, holding its head almost straight up. Ryan took the Sig Sauer from its holster and held it free of the river. Christy did the same with her Smith & Wesson. There was nothing he could do about the Steyr, scabbarded to the saddle, but thoroughly dry, clean, and oil it at the first opportunity. The current was very strong, and Ryan could feel it tugging at his body. He and Christy were at the halfway point of the ford, with Joe only a few feet ahead of them, when a flicker of furtive movement caught the corner of Ryan's eye. He turned his head, looking toward the shore behind him. He saw nothing, only the muddy tracks of their horses.
Ryan!
Yeah?
Do you like trout? As I recollect, the first time we met, you were preparing a muck-sucker stew. I can assure you, trout is preferable, easier on the palate and the digestion.
A feathered shaft miraculously appeared, quivering in the meat of Joe's left shoulder blade. Twisting in his saddle, Ryan glimpsed a blur of a bestial face before it faded into the shadows of the cane. Though he caught only a flickering fragment of motion, the impression he received was of a lupine, wolfish head. The sudden splash brought Ryan's head back around. Joe had passed out and fallen from his horse.
Joe!
Both Ryan and Christy forced their horses forward and flailed with their free hands at the surface. Ryan caught what felt like the fringes on the hem of the deerskin cape. Though his face was almost under the water, he held on.
I've got him! I'm heading to the other bank!
JB, we need help, now!
Ryan urged his horse forward, clinging to Joe's cape. Through a water-blurred eye, he saw JB riding his mount into the river, unslinging his Uzi.
Yeah!
Backbone crawling in anticipation of catching an arrow, Ryan continued to kick his horse toward the riverbank. Splashing out to them, JB grabbed the rope bridle of the Pinto and dragged it toward the bank, water erupting in the wake of their passage.
Yeah!
Making the bank, Ryan leapt off his horse.
Joe, can you hear me?
Who shot me?
I didn't see anybody.
I thought I did. And it wasn't a who, more like a what.
What did you see?
I thought it was a wolf.
What? A wolf that shoots a bow and arrow?
No. No. You saw a man dressed as a wolf. One of the wolf soldiers. I should have known they would lie in wait for me.
Everyone dismounted, and with guns drawn, scanned the opposite shore as the rest of the party joined them. Soon, Mildred had ready what little medical supplies they had.
I'm going to break the shaft, okay?
Okay.
On three. One.
Hey, what happened to three?
It hurts less when you're not expecting it. Let me see the damage here.
Mildred threw back the wet deerskin cape. Joe wasn't wearing a shirt, and the jagged stump of the shaft rose from the muscles of his shoulder, moving with the labor of his breathing. There was very little blood. Quickly, she examined the wound.
Does it hurt?
I've had worse.
Yeah, it hasn't penetrated very far. The arrow was fired at a long range and didn't go very far in the muscles. The angle of it says that if the bow had been stronger and the arrow come in faster, it would have punctured your heart. Would you happen to know if these wolf soldiers use barbed points on their arrows?
No. Leastways, it doesn't feel like it.
Good. The arrowhead has to be withdrawn, and there might be some blood loss. If it's heavy, then we're in trouble, because I don't have the materials to stop a serious flow.
And if it is not withdrawn, then I run the risk of bleeding internally. It has to be removed at once. Go to my pony. In the parflesh, made of badger skin, is my medicine pouch.
Doc?
I am on it, madam.
Doc searched through the bundles tied to the pinto and found the furry pouch. It was decorated with wrapped quill bands and beadwork done in Sioux colors and patterns. He handed it to Mildred. Inside, she found 7 small hide packets of herbs, the entire foot of an eagle, a small piece of elk horn, and a bear claw. On the inner edge of each packet was a small insignia, each different, each in a different color.
take that packet and that packet and put half their contents in a hand.
All right.
Chopped up herbs. One of them is yarrow plant, I think.
Correct.
I'm not sure what the other one is, though.
Buffalo tallow. Dried and ground up.
Okay. What do you want me to do?
Rub the herb and the tallow in your hand. Mix them up.
Done. Now what?
Put the mixture in your mouth. When your saliva has softened it, pull out the arrow and spit the stuff into the puncture. Then smooth it out with your fingers. Make sure the hole is plugged.
Mildred's eyes flicked at the crushed up substance in her hand, and then back to Christy.
Ugh. Mother Sonia ever hear of a remedy like this?
There are many ways to heal, I suppose.
Are you going to do it or not? I thought you were a healer.
I'll do it, but it's not my field. If you wanted me to freeze some part of you, like your tongue, I'd feel more at home.
I'll pass.
Jack, Doc, hold him down.
Mildred popped the concoction into her mouth. As Joe's arms were held down, she sat behind him, planted a foot at the small of his back, grasped the broken shaft, and yanked. Blood began to flow heavily from the wound down his back, the top of his breech clout soaking it up.
Spit it out!
Mildred scored a direct hit on the puncture, and quickly her fingers kneaded the substance, pressing it into the wound, spreading it evenly around the edges. Almost immediately, the bleeding stopped.
I'll be damned. A natural coagulating agent. I'm gonna go wash this residue out of my mouth.
As Mildred went to the river, Joe slowly stood, careful not to place too much strain on his back.
Under the circumstances, I think we'd better find a suitable campsite for the night.
After Mildred rigged a makeshift bandage and arm sling for Joe, they pressed on for another hour. By the time they reached an animal-forged trail in the high grass, the sun was setting. Following a barely defined path, they walked through a thicket and into a small clearing. They set up camp there, unsaddling the horses and mules, picketing them so they could graze nearby. JB dug a foot-deep hole and encircled the edge with piled stones. He kindled a blaze in the hole, and thus no firelight was visible from the Owl Hoot's oven. Doc made a stew from chunks of the jerky, seasoning it with carrots and slices of some unidentifiable root vegetables he had raided from the larder of the hostel in Amicus. All of them ate slowly, since the meat was tough and had to be chewed carefully. Later, they sipped cups of coffee sub. It wasn't particularly delectable, but it was a definite improvement over the bark tea favored by the Amicans. By the time they'd finished eating, stars burned in the blue-black sky. Jack and Christy volunteered to stand the first watch, patrolling the perimeter. Though the firelight was poor illumination, Ryan field-stripped the Steyr and meticulously cleaned and oiled all its moving parts. After reassembling it, he did the same to Joe's weapon. The man watched him silently, but intently.
How are you feeling?
Much better. Tomorrow I'll be much better still.
Good. Then maybe you feel good enough to explain about the wolf soldiers and why they're so anxious to keep you from reaching Tirawa.
I doubt you would believe everything I told you.
Try us.
Very well. Though we are of the same tribe, there are two factions in the valley. The wolf soldiers and the cavern keepers, of which I am a chief. We believe in keeping the high laws, strengthening our spirit bodies, and strengthening the energies of Abbot Dutdea.
Abbot what?
The grandfather. The one above.
Oh, religion. I was afraid of this.
When you strengthen your spirit body, you exercise the high laws against low laws that the material world obeys. The wolf soldiers have abandoned the high laws and practiced the low.
You may have to define the practice of low law. I presume you do not mean divorce proceedings.
Low law is the lust for material power. Power over everything, even the methods of healing Grandmother Earth.
Healing, huh? Explain.
I cannot. It is something you will not believe or even understand until we reach the valley.
Joe drew a blanket around him with such a flourish, it ended the discussion. Leaning against a tree, Ryan looked toward the distant mountain range. clouds squatted on the snowy peaks. Before the Nukost and the Earthshaker bombs, the Continental Divide had followed the crest line of the Wind River Range. God only knew what it was like now, but it was possible it had been unaffected. This was still good, strong country. A couple of hundred years earlier, a government Indian reservation at the base of the Wind River Range had confined the Crow, the Ute, the Bannock, the Sioux, and the Cheyenne. Ryan couldn't help but wonder how they'd felt to look up at those tree-lined hills, carpeted with high, sweet grass, and know they could never roam among them again. The new cost had been a blessing to most Indian peoples, the purification of ancient prophecy. The white man's government had dissolved in a twinkling. And though the world wasn't as rich and beautiful as it had been when the tribes had raced wild and free across the plains and the mountains, this part of the country was still rich and beautiful enough. Setting out at first light, the company of travelers followed an old, overgrown paved road that traced its way across high plains country, flat acres and plateaus of good pasture. In the far distance was the burned-out ruin of an old ranch house. The day dawned overcast with thick clouds, but rain didn't come. The color of the day fit the moods of the travelers, slashed with narrow ravines and steep drop-offs, reminders of the quakes that had shaken the West Coast more than a century earlier. The animals picked their way carefully over the uneven ground, following the crest of a ridge that dipped down into an open meadow. As they continued along the stony slant to the prairie, Jack saw a one-story log cabin set back a quarter of a mile from their path. It squatted in a barren clearing, surrounded by upthrusts of shale and scraggly thornbush. The cabin displayed no sign of human habitation, except for a trickle of smoke that rose from the crude chimney. Also from the chimney fluttered a tattered red flag.
Joe, do you know anything about that cabin?
Yes. An old woman lives there. A seer. What you would call a doom sniffer. Everyone thinks she is touched, so even the tribes leave her alone.
Doomseers, doomies, were human mutants, possessed or cursed with a psychic ability to foresee death. Christie's ability was somewhat similar, but she couldn't visualize exact details, though she often sensed danger in the offing.
What's the flag for?
Means she wants company, or help for a chore. She always pays off in provisions.
Well, the flower got wet at the river crossing. Might be a good idea to mosey down there and trade for some.
Well, I'll go, if someone comes with me.
I'll accompany you. My mouth is already primed for biscuits.
We'll wait for you here.
Doc and Mildred guided their horses down the rock-ribbed slant. A chill wind plucked at their hair and clothing. Their pants were still slightly damp from the river crossing the day before, and they shivered. As they entered the cabin's compound, Doc glanced around, feeling an invisible, strange something emanating from the structure's interior, like radiation. The hairs at his nape tingled, and he looked quickly at Mildred. If she sensed the same thing, she showed no sign of it.
Well, here goes nothing. Shit!
Rigid with fear and astonishment, they saw, tethered to a post at a corner of the log building, a tawny cougar. It was gigantic, a breed spawned by radiation-induced polyploidism, the doubling of all or part of the chromosome complement. Though this monster wasn't as large as the 25-foot puma that had nearly bitten Doc's head off months earlier, it still stretched 15 feet from nose to tail tip and probably weighed 900 pounds. The mouth was open, saliva dripping from the long yellow fangs. It regarded them with calculating brown-green eyes. Looking at the rust-eaten chain that attached the beast to the post, both Doc and Mildred went for their guns.
He will not molest you, stranger.
An old black woman stood in the doorway of the cabin, wearing a collection of colorful rags and scraps of fur.
You saw my flag.
Yes, ma'am. We'd like to trade for some flour.
Trade with what?
Chores or Jack?
The old woman smiled a speculative smile, and for a moment, the expression on her face seemed a mirror image of the cougar's.
What are your names?
Dr. Mildred Wyatt and Dr. T.A. Tanner.
And bad men are doctors today. Well, come on, both of you, and be welcome.
They tied their mounts to a post at the opposite corner from the cougar, and, drawn by a gesture from a black-nailed hand, they crossed the yard and ducked under the low doorway, entering the cabin. Something about the crone's secret smile and easy manner made Doc's hand itch for the comforting weight of his Lama. Surreptitiously, he loosened the ebony case, sheathing the blade of Toledo steel. The old woman stoked the fire of buffalo chips in the shallow hearth, and the flames leapt higher. Mildred and Doc quickly studied the single-room dwelling. The wooden walls were covered by stretched animal hides and grinning skulls, bears with great fangs, longhorn steers, and immense buffalo skulls. Dried herbs, desiccated birds, and mummified reptiles dangled from the rafters. Doc was reminded of an apothecary shop.
Please, sit on the bench. You are strangers to this land, you doctors.
Yes, ma'am.
Why do you ask?
Everyone else fears to enter the abode of the dooming woman. I sniff death, you see. This is how I have lived for so many years, unharmed by the tribes, the beasts, the brigands. I can foretell death, and no one wants to know about it. They are afraid that if they learn the time and manner of their death, it will arrive before they are ready. You come from far, far away, far beyond my range of sight. But I do not concern myself with where you have been. You only look ahead, dreaming golden dreams.
Madam...
It is a poor gift, this doomed sight, but it keeps me safe from harm.
Our companions are waiting for us. We can't stay long.
My sight does not work on command. I see only when my mind is clear and untroubled. Then I may glimpse the deaths of others. Of late I have seen colors. Red for blood, gold for greed, black for doom. I have known for some time that your company of travelers would be passing this away. More, I knew that you two would be the only ones foolish or ignorant enough to come here. Unfortunately, my sight is frequently dimmed, but then others must arrange the doom I cannot see.
Behind Doc, a narrow portal covered with an animal pelt swung open. Before he could draw his gun or Mildred could get to her feet, the razor-keen point of an arrow was thrust into the room. It was followed half a heartbeat later by a crossbow. Two men stepped inside quietly, rail-thin Indians wearing wolfskins, the hollowed-out furry skullcaps resting on their heads like hoods.
They see your dooms. Whether it is a true vision or merely a wish that will never be fulfilled is too soon to know.
By the three...
Inila!
He wants you to be silent.
What else does he want?
What Taneloba? Lactos Weba?
He wants the old one to go to the door and beckon your comrades.
Madam, our comrades are very well armed. This pair would not stand a chance against them.
They want only Utan Ken Mahipia. Do not make it difficult for yourself and your fellow physician.
Doc didn't move. The unarmed warrior approached Mildred. Drawing a knife from his belt, he placed the edge against the side of her neck.
They can kill you. Your people will hear nothing and only much later find your corpses.
The Indian pressed the edge of his knife into Mildred's flesh. She didn't cry out, but she bit her lower lip.
Very well. I shall do as they ask.
Shoulders slumped, Doc shuffled painfully toward the open door, leaning heavily on his cane. When he reached the opening, he ducked his head as if to go through it. Then he paused and half-turned, a questioning look in his eyes. He opened his mouth.
Hopo! Hopo!
Doc lifted the cane as if to administer an admonishing wag. In a single motion, he revealed his sword stick and threw it directly at the wolf soldier. The blade traveled 3 feet before the point struck into the warrior's open mouth, traveling forward to sever the brainstem. The crossbow dropped to the ground, the arrow shooting off and embedding itself in a wall.
Whoa!
The other warrior gave a great leap backward, dragging the edge of the knife along the side of Mildred's neck and drawing a thread of blood. Mildred was on him in a heartbeat. Mildred rolled out of range of the wolf soldier's blade. When she came out of the roll, the ZKR was in her fist. The wolf soldier's extravagant back leap carried him against the hidden door panel. Mildred's shot missed one of the pointed wolf ears by less than a finger's width. The warrior struggled to his feet and raced away from the cabin, across the rear of the compound. Mildred rushed to the opening, aligning the frantically sprinting figure within the sights of her gun. Suddenly, the monster muti cougar ran after the wolf soldier. It caught up with the fleeing human with a few spring steel-legged bounds. The warrior went down amid flying liquid ribbons of crimson. As Mildred watched with a horrid fascination, loops of blue-pink intestines spilled onto the ground. Huge jaws closed over the warrior's head, and the cougar's neck jerked back and forth. Arms and legs flopped, like those of a disjointed marionette. The cat gathered itself and bounded from sight, the flesh-stripped, eviscerated body dangling from its blood-flecked jaws.
What on earth just happened? Did he get away? Oh.
When Doc saw the thick whorls of blood and coils of viscera glistening on the barren ground, he noticeably paled.
It happened so fast, like it had been waiting for him.
He had. He had sharp teeth and a keen nose. He had already sniffed out who was fated to die.
You bitch! How about if I show you your doom?
Mildred, no! She's old enough to be your grandmother!
When the cat came this morning, I knew you were in no danger.
Yeah? How?
I see through his eyes. He knew who would die, and so did I.
Wait, you mean that vicious predator was never chained up?
Oh, no. That would be cruel.
I don't understand any of this.
No need. There's your flower, Dr. Wythe. You better get it back to your friends. They have heard the shot and are already on their way down.
Doc worked the blade of the sword loose from the Indian's open mouth.
What do we owe you?
I've been paid.
Well, at least allow us to remove this carcass from your home.
The old woman straightened and grabbed a wooden spoon next to her.
You don't understand.
She pointed with it toward the corpse.
I've been paid.